I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Du lytter til Rytterjargon podcast. Mit navn er Mads Wirt Schmidt, og jeg er professionel cykelrytter. Så mange af jer gætter rigtigt, så er denne uges gæst Greg Henderson. Greg startede som ung på BMX, men fik sine første gennembrud på banen, inden en lang karriere som professionel på landevejen med flere store sejre. Nu arbejder han som coach på mit hold, Israel Premier Tech. Tak til Matti og Mikkel fra Pro Cycling Quiz for at udlade et spil til en heldig vinder, som netop er trukket fra puljen af alle de rigtige svar. Så tillykke, Lasse Jensen, der bliver sendt et Pro Cycling Quiz brætspil afsted mod dig. Smut gerne omkring iTunes og give en anmeldelse. Det vil jeg sætte stor pris på. Tak, fordi I lytter med.
Greg Henderson, welcome.
Thanks, mate.
How's it going?
Hey, pleasure to be here. Yeah, it's good. Really good.
Yeah, so you're retired pro. You live in Girona. And what you doing now?
Yep, so I used to live in Girona here for 12, 13 years as a professional. And then, once I retired, everyone sort of, like every professional bike rider, I think, shits their pants for a couple of months going, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
And I always had a real passion for the coaching side and the scientific side of things around cycling. So I decided to go back to university and someone shipped back to New Zealand and finish off sport and exercise science degree. Majoring in exercise physiology. I did that for, what do you know?
Phone ringing.
So Eric wants to have a chat to us.
Oh, shit. Direct into team.
Yeah. So I went back and did a finished off my sports science degree. And then I started working with Israel Premier Tech, or Israel Startup Nation back then. I started work with them, but I was sort of commuting from New Zealand, which wasn't so bad in itself until we got struck by COVID.
COVID, yeah. Yeah.
And so every time I was going back to New Zealand, I was doing 2 weeks in a hotel room.
Yeah, because Australia and New Zealand had that crazy rule that you had to be in isolation in a hotel that they picked for 2 weeks. Yeah,
correct. And getting in was so hard, like, because there was such a waiting list to get actually back into the country. It was, and then there was our DS calls and our coaching calls that would happen at like 4 a.m. for me. So it was just, it was horrible times, you know, and I didn't feel like I was integrating with the team very well either. I mean, the riders, I knew all the riders and I got on with the riders, as I do, because I was a recently retired pro, so I really understand the riders and the race as well. It was just the staff and feeling the flow of the team I found really difficult, because I felt kind of like almost ostracized, you know. I'd come in, do a grand tour and a couple of other races, go home. So yeah, so that's when I decided, right, you know, if I'm going to give this job a real crack, I've got to come back here.
Yeah, it's easier in Europe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm on the same time zone. You know, just for example, then Eric can ring me now and have a chat if he wants to talk about something, or anyone in the team can get hold of me.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm in New Zealand, I'm asleep usually.
Also, when you're a coach, it's better to be in the same time zone as your athletes.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Having said that, I do have a lot of New Zealand athletes I do coach on the side.
Okay.
So, yeah, if this is my bread and butter, which is Israel Premier Tech, for sure, be on the same time zone. If the guys want to get hold of me, it's a lot easier, for sure. So, yeah, back over here. I'm living in Fornells, which is, you know, as you know, 5Ks sort of south of Girona, and that's where I lived as a pro here. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, not a lot's changed in Girona. It's busy. I mean, when I first came to Girona, mate, there was like 7 to 10 cyclists?
Yeah.
How many do you reckon are here now?
Fuck me, I don't know. A lot.
I mean, including cyclists, cyclist wives or partners,
yeah,
and influencers and all
that. And then the tourism here has gone crazy over just the last 2 years. It's everything is about cycling here.
Mate, that's one of the reasons I went out, because even as I was leaving, you know, I retired 2017. So when I was living out in Fornells, one of the main reasons was if I lived in Girona City, if I want to walk to the shops and buy something, I would have to bump into three or four bike riders and have the same, hey, mate, how you doing? What's your next race? Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, okay, mate. And it's like...
the classic gruppetto talk.
Yeah. And it's like, dude, I just rode a week with you banging handlebars. I don't want to bang handlebars with you in the supermarket, you know? Right. It's like...
Even where I live, it's better. Like, if you live in the city center, you see people all the time. But here, I'm just 1.5K out of center. Yeah. And I never see anybody here.
Yeah, it's good.
It's better.
I mean, some people love it. I mean, if you're a brand new pro, and that's where you walk down the street, and it's
sweet.
Great.
It's sweet.
It's perfect.
Like, got a thing. Also, some of the charm in Girona is in the city centre.
Oh, no question. Yeah.
So, got to have a few years in there.
Absolutely. And then, of course, beautiful restaurants and dinners. It's nice. You know, it almost feels like we're going out. You know, because instead of just walking out your door into a restaurant, if you live there, you get dressed and you go to a nice restaurant. You plan it for the. It's quite nice.
Yeah. So. You were pro in many years, but you come from New Zealand. And how did it all start with cycling there? Because it's never really been a big cycling nation, has it? And especially, I guess now, it's just me guessing, it's easier to get a pro contract and get to Europe from New Zealand now than back when you had to do it.
Yeah, you're spot on, mate. So for me, my progression sort of, I started with BMX as a kid. You know, I went to the World Champs as a 5-6-year-old kid, you know, and then I moved into track cycling because, as you know, New Zealand's quite, the cycling's dominated by track cycling in New Zealand. But then, you know, it comes a time where I sort of decided, I was at university at the same time, so I was studying, training, racing internationally, and I thought, I've got to find out how far I can take this cycling gig, you know, because at that moment in time, I didn't really have any ambitions of the Tour de France, or I didn't really follow European racing much. It was just time to go, right, how far can we go? So, you know, I won a couple of world titles on the track, and, you know, I ended up in my career going to 5 Olympics, track and road. But my first pro team was over in America. And again, it was one of these sort of stair steps. I was just stepping my way through. So I got to the top of American cycling, you know. Yeah. I'd won the races that the pros come over, you know, Philly Week and won Sprint Jersey and Tour of Georgia, Tour of California, all those races. So I was like, well, maybe I am good enough now to go to Europe.
Yeah.
So that's when I really pushed, was like 2006. I said, right, I'll see what it's like. And yeah, I performed in front of T-Mobile. I won Philadelphia, won Lancaster. These big American races that, you know, 6 or 8 pro teams from Europe came over to race. And yeah, I was lucky enough to get a contract with T-Mobile, and that's how it sort of all started. But
that's where you started your run with Andre already.
Correct.
Back then. Yeah. So that took you into that part of your career.
Correct. Yeah. So that was, it was a steep learning curve. I mean, you come from America over to Europe.
Yeah, we still see it now with American kids coming to Europe, and they have to learn it.
Yeah,
it's so different.
Yeah, and so my big thing that I tell the young guys coming up now, and I made a pact too with myself, was you can't think of this as a halfway home, and you can't say Europe's not really my home. You have to go, right, bang, I'm in here, I'm doing this, Europe's my home, I'll go back to New Zealand to visit. Whereas a lot of Kiwi guys that have come over, they sort of, oh, I'm not really in Europe, I'm just got it like, and so, I mean, Tom Scully would be a prime example. I said, mate, spend a lot of money on your sofa and your TV and the PlayStation, or just things. So when you finish a bike race and you've had your head beaten in for a week, think about on the flight going, oh, mate, I can't wait to crash on my couch. So you actually look forward to getting home to your apartment. And I think that's a mistake a lot of the young pros from America and New Zealand make. They go, oh, it's not really home. You know, Aussie's my home, or New Zealand's my home, or America's my home.
Yeah.
You have to change that mentality and go, right, this is where I'm based. Can't wait to get on my couch and play my PlayStation, you know, and it makes such a difference.
So in your career, you were a lead-out guy, one of the best. But major wins, what do you have?
Yeah, so I morphed into that job, lead-out. So I was a sprinter, you know, Giro stage, Vuelta stage, couple of Paris stages, you know, so I won on the top level and against the big boys. So it was possible for me to win, you know, Catalunya, ZLM Tour. Like, you know, I won enough, often enough. I was a pretty classy sprinter. I was a pretty clever sprinter. But then it came to a point where, you know, when I rode for Sky 2010, I won 9 races that year. So it's actually not a bad... You know, if you go by today's standards, winning 9 races, it's quite consistent.
Then you're in the top.
Yeah, I was a consistent winner. But then I was getting on in age also. And, you know, like I said, I'm quite a clever sprinter. So then I worked out. I changed because I remember saying to my partner at the time, I'm going, if I come head-to-head right now in a bunch sprint and I've got Andre Greipel, Mark Cavendish, Marcel Kittel, and we all have our good sprint, I'm going to get fourth.
Yeah.
And as a sprinter, you don't get paid for fourth.
No.
So I was like, I reckon I always got on with Andre, even though we sprinted against each other often, I knew the only way I could beat Andre was start 5 bike lengths in front of him because his positioning wasn't perfect, but that was my attribute, was positioning. I'd always find myself at the pointy end of a bike race. And I did it with ease. So that's what, I guess, then led on to being a good sprinter. So then I was like, well, if I work with Andre again, because his one fault is positioning. He really struggles in that last 1 or 2 kilometres on how to get to the front.
Maybe we should just say, when we talk about Andre, we talk about Andre Greipel.
Yeah, Andre Greipel, the gorilla.
Yeah.
Yeah, so so then the year before I went to work with him, he won 9 races or 11 races. So a really good season.
Yeah.
The year I went for him, worked for him in 2012, he won 22 races. It just became,
boom,
instant. We just clicked, you know, and then we designed a lead out. Then we had Jürgen Rawlins, then we had Adam Hansen, Marcel Seberg. And, we just had this train for 5 years that was just, when we said go at 2.5 Ks to go, mate, it was single file, 70 Ks an hour. It was hanging on for dear life. It was so fast.
By the way, you were just at his retirement party. How was that?
Mate, it was really cool. You know, that was, I think that was a testament to the culture that we had at Lotto Balasol Sordell. You know, it was, I mean, that we had DS's there, mechanics, Swanier's, the whole lead out train was there.
Yeah.
You know, Lars Bach was there. And it just shows how good we got on still, you know. And I think there's no question, you know, culture drives performance.
Yeah.
And the culture we had in that team was just, we were like brothers, and we would ride through a brick wall for each other, and that's what made us so dominant for so many years. There was no egos, there was no, you know, there was no backstabbing. It was just, mate, we're here. And Gripe was such a good leader. He was such a good winner that, you know, he would always be the first person to go, I couldn't do this without my guys, and he would reward us appropriately, you know. Like, He knew. He didn't take us for granted, that's for sure. It wasn't just all the Andre Greipel show, and that's why he's such a respected athlete that he is.
Yeah, yeah. I was lucky to have a few seasons with him, and he's one of the best teammates I ever had. So, he's good. Okay, getting on. So the podcast in Danish is called Rytterjargon, which means rider lingo, and every guest has to bring some certain lingo or cycling expression from where you're from something you used to say, maybe something back from your Lotto days with Andre, or just a cycling word or expression.
Yeah, I guess it's the one word, it's quite difficult, I guess, when you think about it, because cycling lingo in itself is almost another language.
Yeah.
You know, you and I could just sit here and talk cycling all day, and the person down the street wouldn't actually know what the hell we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
But there's something like I used to always say is on the radio, I'd be, righto boys, let's throw it in the gutter.
Yeah.
And it's like,
that's a good one.
But no one would actually know what that meant. If it's the person down the street, what does throw it in the gutter mean? It means literally if the wind is coming from the right, we're going to go flat stick on the left-hand side of the road and put everyone in trouble because they're not going to get any shelter from a crosswind.
Yeah.
So it's always, throw it in the gutter, boys. Left side.
And yeah, exactly.
I just love that one because it was like when it came on the radio, it was go time.
Yeah, that's a good one. It hasn't been on before.
Yeah.
So throw it in the gutter.
Throw it in the gutter,
throw
boys.
Throw it in the gutter. Okay. Then let's move on. Your favorite training loop. And it's more like, what's the loop? It's, you have favorite efforts, climbs, whatever, cafe stop, if you're a coffee stop guy.
I'm definitely not a coffee stop guy, no. But I tell you what, around here, my favorite loop is that Vic loop, you know, when you head out St. Gregory, Las Planas, out through a lot over the big climb. What's that climb called?
Condreu, whatever.
Sure. Yep. Drop down towards Vic, then back up over into...
Sant Hilari.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's my favorite ride. And there was certain areas, that, like good tempo climbs for me as a sprinter, you know, like good long 20-minute effort climbs that I could do.
Big ring. Big ring too.
Big chop off in the big ring. And then there was some nice gradual downhills where I could get some really nice fast leg speed and then come off with a free lead out and do a couple of really good sprints too. So it was kind of my little all-round ride. And I didn't even have to structure intervals on that ride. I just knew that if I got around that ride and did it in X amount of time or kilometres an hour, I had some good legs.
Yeah. And then why are you not a coffee stop guy?
I think that changed as I got older, you know. It's like, you know, with kids, I just wanted to get home, get out, get the work done. 4 hours is 4 hours, you know. I might stop for water if it's stinking hot in the summer,
yeah,
you know, but a 4 hour, I got other shit to do now. You know, it's not like I can, 4 hours can turn into 6 hours. I've got, yeah, you know, it just happened like that. And it's like, yeah, I mean, otherwise cycling, I mean, it's already a huge part of your life. You know, as a professional athlete, you're the most selfish human beings on the planet, because all you think about is how my legs are feeling, how far is my ride today, how do I recover best when I get home. It's all me as a professional athlete. And don't get me wrong, you have to be.
It has to be like that.
But if you look in the real world, you're not going to go far in the real world if you are that selfish. But professional sport, and it's not just cycling, it's professional sport. You have to be selfish to be the best in the world. But then you start realizing as you get older, it's like, you know what, I got this to do when I get home. I got this. I got to go get these kids. I got to go the shopping. Or I'm going to cook dinner tonight. So it's just that sort of, more probably for the last 7 or 8 years in my career, I just get out, get the work done, come home. 4 hours is 4 hours.
Yeah, I'm actually turning into the same. On the big rides, I usually go on my own, and then I don't have a coffee stop. Mm. It's better to just get it done. Yeah. Okay. Your craziest day ever on the bike. You must have a lot, because you were a pro for how many? 17 years?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, I'll tell you one that never leaves me is the
20. That's the one we want to hear about.
Yeah. Hold on. Here we go.
Can I guess it's probably from the Giro?
No.
No. Okay.
No. I mean, there's a few.
Most guys are from the Giro, but anyway.
A few mongrel guts days in the Giro. Don't you worry about that.
Yeah.
But my worst day was 2013 Milan San Remo.
Oof.
Mate, it started off in Milan. Actually, here's how the day started. This is how bad the day was. So I had my my nice white national champion Ridley bike parked. Beautiful. Anyway, mechanics took after it. We went to sign on, came back into the bus for the last coffee before it was freezing out, you know. It was just raining in Milan. Anyway, come out for the race and I'm like, Steve, mate, seen my bike? I thought he must be just adjusting the brakes or changing the tire pressure. Where's my bike, bro? And his face just went boom, instant panic. And I went, oh, this isn't normal, mate. They fucking someone nicked my bike.
No way.
Between sign on and fucking I'll start the day on a spare bike.
I've never heard about that before.
Yeah, mate. Filthy, beautiful, brand new Ridley, white painted.
Oh, with silver fern and everything?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I thought surely it'll turn up on eBay somewhere. I have not seen it, man.
Shit.
So that's how the day started, in the rain and the cold. And then as we headed towards it, just the Cicchino, it just got, the rain turned to hail, turned to sleet, turned to full-on snow, mate.
Yeah.
For 150Ks, we're just frozen to the bone because you couldn't.
Remember Lars, he was in the breakaway.
He was in the breakaway.
And he told stories that he needed the mechanic in the car to open his bars and gels, whatever, for him because.
Mate, and they
couldn't do anything.
He couldn't do a thing. Could not. And you were mate, it's the first time I've heard grown men in the peloton crying.
Yeah.
Just so much pain, hands and feet.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous. And so they stopped the race at 150 Ks before the Chiquino Pass. We got on the buses.
Oh, it's been horrible up there if you had to go there.
Right. We couldn't. The roads were too slippery now.
Yeah.
There's so much snow. So anyway, we get in the bus and everyone's just, you know, like shaking and and I go to jump in the shower and just turn it up full hot. And Greipel just grabs me, goes, "No, Hindi, no. You'll kill you if you go hot water."
Yeah,
you'll just kill yourself.
Yeah, that would be way worse.
Yeah, and he turned the water on cold and I jumped in the cold shower and it was hot, it's mate.
Burning still, yeah.
I was like, this is ridiculous. And we had a team meeting and then I think Quickstep decided not to start because it was optional. Do you want to start now? Because what they did, they took us in the buses down into the other side of San Remo.
To the coast road.
Where it was only raining.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where, oh, you're going to start? Oh, you're starting too?
Nobody really wants, but it's like group pressure.
Yeah, for sure. Group pressure. Oh, yeah. You're doing it? Ah, fuck it. Yeah, all right, I'll do it. And the problem was, you used all your good warm clothes too. Yeah. So it's still raining and cold, but all your good clothes, really ones that keep you warm, which we're doing fuck all, to be honest, that we were all frozen, but they're all wet now.
Yeah.
So you're putting on your second sort of level clothes. Anyway, started that race.
Always what you have in Rainback 2. It's never really the good stuff.
All bits and pieces, you know. Yeah. Maybe a bit from last season even, you know. But anyway, we're riding along and I was just going, this is ridiculous. And I remember doing an interview afterwards and, you know, I still stand by it. It was like the race became a race where there's only about 20 people in the world that can function in those temperatures. The rest of us were just riding around trying to get to the finish.
Yeah.
There was probably only 20 guys that could actually function. I remember going uphill, and this is no joke. I was going up one of the Copper Bertas or whatever it was, leading into the one of the ones leading into the base of Suppressor. And I was going up there and I was pushing as hard as I possibly could, but I could have a conversation with you like this now. My legs would not function. So I couldn't tax cardiovascular. It was just muscular. They just
wouldn't
function.
You couldn't get your heart rate up.
I just couldn't push any harder. They were just blocks of ice. So that was my most miserable day on the bike. I'll never forget that. That was horrible.
Oh, great story, man.
that's the coldest one. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What is your favorite race?
It's a difficult question, isn't it? In total, I think it's probably the Tour de France.
Yeah.
For me, I used to love the pressure. I really performed when there was pressure on me or on the team, and just the biggest events used to really inspire me. Like from my track background, I loved the World Championships. I loved the Olympics. You know, I really performed on a really high level. I mean, I was a good trainer. I trained well. I was a very diligent trainer, but it's not like I set any records on the training bike in training peaks on a training ride.
Yeah, yeah.
It was all in races.
Yeah.
It was like I just put a number on my back and I just changed into a sort of a different weapon, you know? And I think there's a lot to be said for that sort of bike rider because, you know, I coach a lot of athletes now and I have done over the years. A lot of their peaks and their powers and everything, they do these huge numbers in training. They're just like watt monsters in training. And you put them in a bunch.
A lot of guys, they're trainers, not racers, actually.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
I see it time and time again. These amazing climbers, well, on paper climbers, they do huge watts per kilo for 5, 10, 20-minute profiles, whatever their profiles are.
Yeah.
They can't ride in a peloton. They start the climb at the back of the bunch. Like, what good is that, mate? So I'm sure you know the type of person I'm talking about, but I just feel that as an athlete myself, it was my biggest numbers. Was sometimes I'd look down at the numbers on the SRM and just go, I don't even want to see that number because mentally.
Instantly you turn your head, I can't do this.
I can't do this number. Exactly. So I used to, honestly, when the SRM, because I was in one of the new Bs that came out and we had SRMs, it was still new power. I would put some tape over the SRM number during races.
Yeah.
So I don't want to see 650 watts at the bottom of a 20K climb.
No. No way.
Because if you see that, you go, I know I can't do that. And so you just talk to yourself, like, instead of going, fuck, I'm going to hang on for dear life and see how far up this climb I get, then deal with the consequences.
Yeah.
And then, sure, the peloton might slow in 5 minutes and comes right back there and you recover. But if you see 650, you're like, I can't do this all the way to the top. Chances are Nobody can do that all the way to the top.
Exactly.
But when you see that number just blinking in your eyes, you're like, I'm going to blow.
What was the best year in the tour then?
So 2012 or 14, I'm not sure which one, Groppa won 5 stages. And, I was obviously his last meet-up man for every single one. I mean, there was times where we were that dominant where I would be posting, and there's a number of photos. I'm in the background doing my victory salute. Greipel's still sprinting.
He's still sprinting.
And I'll roll across the line for 5th or 6th. Like, that's how fast we were going. And I'm coming off the back of Jürgen Rawlins, you know, who's in, coming off Marcel Seberg. So our last 1.2 kilometres was just... It was just fire.
Oh, I gotta go watch some YouTube from back then.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, some of the stages were, and just how early we had it dialed, you know. And you know, you can't take, as you know, to get a bunch sprint takes a lot of work before. So we had these demons on the front that would ride for us, you know. And Lars Bach being one, you know, he could just turn the taps at 350 watts all day or whatever it took.
On his good days, he was like, amazing. Eh?
He could just control. He could control 5 guys.
Yeah.
So how's he
just
do
on
that?
His own?
And then you know the other sprinter teams would come. Oh, we'll come. Always their talk. Oh, we'll come and help after the feed. You know. So Lars is on his own to what feeds at 120 k's usually,
and he's still there with 5k to go.
It's still 5k to go, holding us in position.
Yeah,
racing the best. So it takes a lot to prepare a sprint. But
did you guys win in Paris then?
Yeah, twice.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah, that was a nice feeling.
Must be a big party when you win in Paris.
Yeah, we back in those days, you could have family, friends, and everyone's just on the bus. So this lotto bus was like, I remember it was just sunk down to the ground, like the suspension. We must have had 50, 60 people on the bus. There was nowhere to sit. It was all standing room only.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was awesome, you know, and... Yeah, quite a few years we chased that green jersey, but you know, unfortunately, we come up against a very, very good Peter Sagan. It was just, and he wasn't, you know, he's clever as well. He knew, okay, I'm going to finish close to Greipel in the sprints, but not beat him one on one. But I'm going up the road any chance I get over a small hill and pick up full points. So it was really difficult to actually win the green jersey.
Mm. What about the worst race for you?
Well, worst as in don't like?
Yeah. Which race did you hate going to?
It's not that it's almost a different word than hate. Like, probably feared would be a better...
Yeah, you can also say
that. Yeah, a better description, because it would be those early classics like Gent-Wevelgem, Kerner. Kerner was okay. Maybe Het Volk back in those days. Het Nieuwsblad.
I've done Gent-Wevelgem where it's been crosswind from kilometer zero. That's, and it's a 250, 60 kilometer bike race.
And freezing cold. And left, right, up, down, cold, left, right.
You go to the coast and you get back and it's, oh.
Mm-hmm.
When I did it was, I think for 3 hours, the first 3 hours of a 6 hour race were a bit more than 300 average power.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah, so that they just instilled that. But then again, I don't think fear is a bad thing, because you race really smart and you race hard when you've got some fear.
Did it that year when people were blowing off the road?
Yes. And that's the thing. Even when I was scared of them, I was actually quite good at them. You know, I think my best result was I finished 15th or 13th there one year. You know, like when it's in ones and twos and threes or whatever. So I was actually quite okay at them. But actually, a story that my biggest fear, I think, was the first time I did Roubaix.
Yeah.
Man, that bunch, like, it's basically a bunch. There's two bunch sprints. The first bunch sprint is to the first sector of cobbles.
Yes.
And, you know, I positioned okay, not too bad.
The thing is, in Roubaix, when you start the cobbles, the position you have on the first sector is more or less the position you will have for next 50, 60, 70K.
Yes.
Until you are riding from Haveluy to Dinard.
Yeah.
Because there you still have a few, like maybe 10, 12 kilometers where the whole peloton can bunch up and positions can change. But from the first sector until then, if you're top 20, from the first sector, you're top 20 when you enter Haveluy.
For sure. And that's why everybody wants to be.
Yeah.
That's why it's a bunch sprint. So that was
it's a mad one, that one.
But your first time ever doing Roubaix. And then I'll never forget the Aardenburg Forest. Like, here's this famous forest that I don't even think cars should drive down. It's that bumpy.
Yeah.
It's slightly downhill. And I just had this surreal moment where I just thought, what the fuck are we doing right now? We were literally sprinting as fast as we could to get to this fucking cobble section.
And it's downhill.
At 70-something Ks an hour.
Yeah.
What are we doing?
That was one time I've entered Arenberg with the Peloton, and it was the most scary moment in my entire career.
Yep, that's what I'm saying.
Because you get into the forest and it's barriers on both sides. People are standing there cheering, flags are hanging on the road, and you enter that with 65, 70 K an hour. I was like, fuck.
Fully broke.
Still having goosebumps from being there, being in the position fighting, like,
yeah, man.
They're like, oh, this is sad.
And the Arenberg Forest is wet or damp 365 days a year.
Yeah.
It's not dry. They're slippery cobbles.
Yeah, with moss in between cobbles. And
So they're the ones I sort of feared the most. You know, I mean, I could talk about like some mountain stages or, you know, there's always fear of time cut and it's like, oh, shit, I might be on the beach this time tomorrow, you know, and in the Giro or the Tour with those hard starts. But, I mean, it wasn't like it was just part of the job, you know. It wasn't like I hated it. It was just part of the job. But the fear part was like, you know, I never got scared in a bunch sprint. I never got scared descending. I never, you know, I love that sort of stuff. But the actual fact that what are we doing right now? Sprinting towards stones.
Yeah.
That was just a bit mad.
Wow. Okay, then I have this one where it's called Who's Your Nemesis in Cycling? Who was that? We all have the guy or few guys that we simply doesn't like. If we see them in the peloton, we're like, fuck off.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there was just a couple of dodgy French sprinters, I think, that I just... it wasn't like I hated them. It was just...
But you know, you have them, those guys who are always a topic at the dinner table. Or
like that. Yeah, yeah. But we, in our bus, we had a list and we used to write, and some guy would come and grab the pen because he's all pissed off and write this name. What happened, Lars? What happened? Oh, this motherfucker. And then you'd have a nice story. So, yeah, there was a few. For me, it was like the sprinter Dumoulin, and I just knew if I was around him, there's some trouble was going to happen. Yeah. He was going to clip a pedal in a corner or he's going to bump someone. He was just messy, you know. And for me, a bunch sprint or a lead out or the arrival into the final, it's all about smooth and calm and just pick your line and commit to the line. Don't move. It's not damn. It's not on off the gas. For me, it's about as smooth as possible, carrying as much entry and exit speed of corners. And just be really calm and relaxed about every move you make in the final 2K. Not erratic. And when he's around you, everything was erratic, mate.
Yeah.
So he was probably one of the guys that he was often on our love list in the bus.
Love list. Yeah. What was his... Sam.
Yeah.
Dumoulin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Small guy.
Mm-hmm.
So you were... Yeah. You're our guy in Israel. You're the lead out guy who's giving up the whole, you do the whole preparation, talk through the sprints and everything. But so you're a lead out expert. Maybe explain to the listeners the perfect lead out.
Yeah, so that's a pretty big title to be bestowed upon me. But it's, I think the fact that I'm able to do that is just, I think, the respect that the riders have for the job I did as an athlete, as a pro, and how often we pulled it off. It wasn't like we had the good plan and we got it one time out of 10. Like when we were there and we nailed it every single time. And for me, a lot of it was the communication and just the trust that, because I was the guy calling the shots in front of Greipel, stay left side, you know, and they're like, how the fuck does he know to stay left side? But you know, I'd done this Google search, I'd looked at the road, I knew, or I've done the sprint 10 times before.
Yeah.
Stay left side, wait. And then the call would come, yep, now we go, because everyone gets nervous in a bunch sprint. Wait, no, don't go, you know, because I don't know what it is, but I'm just nice and cool and calm. When everyone's around me and panicking, I was always cool and calm. But so the key to a bunch sprint, sorry to answer your question, I went on a bit of a tangent there. Answer your question, it's a smooth delivery of power that increasingly gets faster. So, you know, you can start anywhere from 5Ks out. And when I say starting, it means, and this is the thing I had to teach Matthias Brandley, was if I say at the front, it means at the front, not on the front.
Yeah.
So there's a big difference because, and then when you're, when you decide it's time to go, you don't have to just go full gas, noise, 100%. You race the guy that's beside you. You only just have to be, and if you see a turn, or like that, and I'll have done the pre...
5K to go, it's 10 guys half-wheeling.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you can just slip back that half-wheel or three-quarter bike length, you can take a lot of shelter.
Mm.
So you're actually still, you're at the front, but not on the front. And that's, I repeat that time and time again. Guys, we're at the front, we're not on the front. And you can see the teams that are on the front and going full, they're nowhere in the final 2K.
Yeah.
And then if it comes to a corner, I've said, mate, we need to be, you need to turn top five in this corner, make sure, and then wait for your team. Bom, 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 you know, because I'll tell them, what, and then the roundabout, what side, I've looked at the roundabout, mate, shortest left side of this roundabout, don't go right side, you're going to lose 20 places. Small things like that. And then 2K is kind of your launch time. That's when you can put all your watts down.
Yeah.
And you know, and the distance each rider does gets shorter, but the speed gets faster.
Yeah.
So like our last man, say for Giacomo or whoever we had sprinting, Zabel, he would take off at 500 or 450 and do 250 and drop the sprinter off at 200.
Yeah.
So the sprinter does 200, lead up man 250, 300. Guy in front of him would be maybe 300, 350. It's sort of, as it gets faster, obviously the distance gets shorter. But then there's a lot of different variations of sprints. Are we headwind? You know, we shorten it up. If it's tailwind, we lengthen it. You know, you can go longer in a tailwind. Is it technical? Great. Get to the front early in a technical one, because when you go through the corner first, you don't have to go around that corner as fast as humanly possible.
You don't have a gap to close after the corners. Like, then you're setting the speed.
But the key with every corner is you can set the speed spot on, but you get 15 metres freewheeling into the corner, through it, and then you have to wait, if you're early, and wait for and then go. So you're getting 15 seconds rest.
Yeah.
So you can extend again. So if it's really technical, you can take your time through the corners and dictate. So there's a lot of tactics that come into, but that's where a lot of prep into a bunch sprint comes in. And, you know, I'm meticulously look through Google Maps, but that's the thing I enjoy too, is work at how I would prepare this. Now, if I had Andre on my wheel, how would I do this?
Yeah.
And it's because it's essentially the same sort of setup that we have. Alex Dowsett, Mateus Brandley, Zabel, Giacomo, Jente Beermans, we had him there at the Giro as well. So we did have some horsepower.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's basically it. It's a progression in speed over probably the last... You holding position from 5K to 2K at the front, not on the front. And then 2Ks to go is when you can start lighting the afterburners.
Yeah. Cool. We're in the off season now. When you were a rider, what did you look forward to the most when the season was ending? How'd you like to spend your time in off season?
Yeah, so I'd migrate back to summer. So I'd head back to...
You go back to... Yeah, you had summer all year round.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I'd go back, you know, down under, whether it was New Zealand or Australia. But yeah, there was just plenty of time on the beach, you know, hanging out on the beach. It was nice. It was, but I mean, off seasons are so short now. They just don't last that long. By the time you've gone on a holiday, you know, and then you've gone and done a few engagements or talks or sports awards, and next thing you're starting to strap on the boot laces again and going for a bike ride.
I'm already training now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So,
but I mean, you check the Instagram, you know, social media. It's so obvious now. You check social media. Everyone likes to let people know how much they're training now, but it's almost like there's no off season. Like some guys go straight from road cyclocross or track. So there's actually some other forms of exercise that they start doing now. So that's definitely changed a lot since I was an athlete for sure.
Yeah. Get on the beers.
Have a few beers, absolutely. We can relax that a little bit.
I think now when I got you talking like this, it's the first time I finished a beer before you.
There you go. You know how to beat me now. You found a tactic.
Yeah, just got to get you talking. Yeah. Cool, Greg. Thanks a lot for being here.
Pleasure.
Good stories.
Good stories. We'll spin a few more after a few more beers, mate.
I'll bring the recorder for a night.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Funny.
Thank you, man.
Welcome. No, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Sweet. I'll get her to do a photo and then we're done.
Easy.